This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Renee Montagne.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. Good morning. Today in Your Health, we have the second of two reports about mental health problems on campus. The number of students seeking psychiatric help is on the rise. That's true from small community colleges to elite universities. Last week, we told you about the problem. Today, NPR's Deborah Franklin tells us what some schools are doing about it.
A new crop of freshmen arrived on the Stanford University campus in California last month. It was a blue sky day as they stood in line outside the dorms waiting for room assignments from the student resident assistants.
Got your name tag and all that jazz, PO box key, in this little packet.
Looking on, Stanford residence dean, Arcadio Morales. He and his family have an apartment in the dorms, and he's helped usher in every new class for 15 years. In a quieter moment, Morales told us that there have always been some students who pack emotional baggage along with their laptops and books, but the mix of problems he sees have changed.
Early on, most of the issues that surface were roommate issues, sort of compatibility issues.
He still gets that stuff, along with anxiety over midterms. But these days, Morales is seeing some more serious mental health issues, too.
We're getting students that wouldn't have been here 10 years ago because they're on antidepressants or antipsychotic medication, and they're functioning, you know, fairly well.
But it can be a big challenge for the colleges when these students have crises, which has been happening more often at Stanford and other schools. Those middle-of-the-night calls are very hard for any school and any student.
I was just going through a depression, but it was a depression that was getting worse and worse.
Amanda Gellander, now a Stanford senior, has bipolar disorder with symptoms that are mostly evened out with medication. But that night in the dorm 2 years ago, the bottom fell out, and she called a family member.
I was in hysterical tears. I was making remarks, you know, what's the point, you know, just things that a depressed person would say. I was really sad.
But not suicidal, she says. She just needed to vent. After that, Amanda hung up the phone and went to sleep. She had no idea her family was worried enough to call 911.
And about an hour later, there's banging on my door. I go to the door. There's two armed police who barge in. And they're talking about, you know, where are your pills? Where are your pills? And they start ransacking through my entire room. They're opening drawers. They're going through my shelves. And I'm half naked. I'm dressed for bed. And, you know, they're like, are you going to kill yourself? Are you going to kill yourself? I'm just like, no, I'm not going to kill myself. And they're threatening to take me to the psych ward. And they've got their handcuffs in their hands. And I don't know what you say to convince someone that you're not going to kill yourself besides, no, I'm not going to kill myself.
The police phoned the psychiatrist on call, and after some back and forth, they left. But the whole experience left Amanda horribly shaken. She understands the police have been asked to deal with suicide threats this way. It's protocol. She doesn't blame her family. They just wanted to keep her safe.
But that's the option that loved ones have. If they fear for someone, they have to call the police.
Of course, figuring out on the spot who's a risk to themselves and who's not isn't easy for anyone. Stanford's Arcadio Morales helps train student residence assistants in the dorms.
And I always tell the RAs, better to have someone angry and alive than dead and dead.
Everyone agrees it's much better to get help for a troubled student before they're in crisis. All across the U.S., concerned colleges, students, and parents are trying to do just that. Amanda Gellander started a theater project to bring mental illness into the light. And down the street from Stanford, a former Palo Alto mayor and his wife, Vic and Mary Ojakian, became mental health advocates after their son Adam died by suicide at the University of California, Davis, in 2004.
We determined that he became very anxious due to a certain situation, what's called a triggering event, and it was ultimately severe depression that caused his death.
Mary Ojakian and her husband didn't know their son was depressed. He never talked about it. But after Adam died, they interviewed his friends, people in the counseling center, police, professors, even the chancellor. And that's when they learned about the shortage of therapists on college campuses and about how little training most faculty and even police get in how to recognize and handle mentally ill students.
We realized, and they realized, that there was a lot that could be done to change the situation on campus.
The whole situation just makes Vic Ojakian angry.
Guess what? What's going on right now isn't acceptable. We took a look at our situation and we said to ourselves, we don't want another good human being dying. And we decided to
We decided to do something about that, not to sit back, not to do another study. We decided we were going to go save lives.
Yeah, someone's got to draw the line.
Someone else has drawn the line, or tried to. The International Association of Counseling Services recommends that in order to keep students safe and healthy, a college campus should have a minimum of one therapist for every 1,000 to 1,500 students. When you fall short of that, and many colleges do, the wait lists for students seeking help can get very, very long. And research shows that students who get stuck on these wait lists are more likely to drop out of school. Vic Ojakian.
When you have an illness, most of us want to be treated immediately. If you break your arm, you don't want somebody saying to you, you're going to have to wait 2 to 6 weeks.
But that's the sort of wait time Stanford students faced last year until the university hired 6 more therapists. At the same time, it introduced a new system to triage phone calls so that the neediest students could get in to see a counselor right away. The university hired psychiatrist Dr. Ron Albuquer to head the counseling center.
It was a pretty intense trial by fire when I first got here. There were quite a few things going on at the same time.
Psychiatric hospitalizations were up. So were the number of students who needed medication as well as therapy. And most students who want or need long-term counseling still have to be referred to therapists off campus.
Because even with that many counselors, we're still incredibly busy.
When Stanford's endowment took a big hit last year and the school had to slash its budget, it chose not to lay off therapists. It did add a new fee for all students, about $500 a year, with most of that money going to mental health services. Daniel Eisenberg is a mental health researcher at the University of Michigan. He says in these very tight financial times, some other universities and colleges are making tough choices.
College campuses see their central mission as being education. And so I think there's sometimes a question about whether mental health services really fits into that central mission.
Vic and Mary Ojakian, whose son died in the midst of a deep depression, think society doesn't have a choice. Some big fixes will cost big money, and they think it's a good investment given the statistics. Half of all cases of mental illness first show up in the early teen years, and 75% by age 24. Vic Ojakian says college is prime time to intervene and get these young adults on a healthy path. He also has ideas for high school seniors and their parents.
For parents, they need to look at a college not just in terms of its academic credentials. They need to make sure that the mental health service they provide on campus, they need to get an idea of what they're doing and how well they're doing it.
Asking about the number of counselors and what services they have for students after hours. That's just a start, he says. Some other mental health tools are just as important and cheap enough that even financially strapped colleges should have them in place.
How do they communicate their services? Because that's a critical thing. You know, how do they use their web, some of these social networking tools? Do campuses have peer support groups?
Amanda Gellander, who was so depressed 2 years ago, says support from friends, family, and her doctor, along with a change in her medication, were all crucial to helping her get back on track.
Now, every day's a struggle, but I have more hope. I'm applying to a lot of postgraduate programs. I'm actually excited about my future.
Bipolar disorder is still a part of her, Amanda says, but it doesn't define her. Deborah Franklin, NPR News.
Robert, I'm hosting this week, as you know, from Southern California. Lots of great things about being out here, as you know. There is, though, one downside, and that is that I'm missing out today on something very special there in Washington.
That's right. It's something that has become an all things considered Monday tradition.
Cake!
That's Melissa Gray. She's one of our producers. And listeners, I bet a lot of you have someone like her in your office. Just about every Monday, she dashes off a staff email that goes something like this.
Up front, we've got sweet potato pound cake. Still warm. Dig in. Don't be shy.
Well, that goes without saying on our staff. When Melissa started bringing cake into the office, she discovered we will eat just about anything. Her adventures in baking and our adventures in eating what she created are now told in a cookbook. It's called All Cakes Considered, a year's worth of weekly recipes tasted, tested, and approved by the staff of All Things Considered. And before I headed out here to NPR West, I popped over to Melissa Gray's house outside Washington as she put one of those cakes together.
Look over here.
This is where it all happens, this little itty-bitty kitchen.
This little tiny RV-sized kitchen, yeah.
She decided to make that sweet potato pound cake perfect for this time of year.
Now I have a bunch of sweet potatoes that I baked last night, which is one reason why the house smells so good.
They look great.
Melissa, do you want to do this?
Are we going to mash?
Yeah, I'm going to let you mash.
I love mashing.
Melissa Gray steers her book toward the beginning baker with tips she's learned along the way from family and friends, often laced with her trademark Southern sass. Don't stomp around the kitchen while your cake is baking, she writes. Proceed with your cleanup placidly and calmly, like you're on Prozac or Valium, and everything is fine, fine, fine with the stock market. Our sweet potato pound cake batter is thick, a pretty pale orange.
This is a 1 hour and 15 minute one. And I got
a couple of hours and a subway ride later, Melissa arrives at the office cake in hand, and it exerts a gravitational pull on our staff.
It's a sweet potatoes in it, which are healthy.
Oh my God.
Man.
And nuts, which are also
healthy. All right, can I have a thimbleful?
Is Tom here today?
That looks so great. Yeah. He is.
He needs to get down quick.
Okay, should I page him?
Yeah.
The cake is gone in less than 10 minutes. A new land speed record, Melissa says with pride.
Would you like to take some of the crumbs off of our...
Whatever you give me, I will eat happily.
Melissa Gray says it's that kind of reaction that keeps sending her back to her mixer.
I love watching our staff, all of these incredibly competent, brilliant, efficient people, taken back to being like 8 years old. And having that little joy, oh, there's cake. I love that because it makes you remember that people at their core are still, you know, human beings.
Are you sort of peeking over the edge of your cubicle, kind of watching the response, seeing?
I keep track of who doesn't get cake. I do, and I check with them, and I'm like, did you get a slice of cake today? You know, I want everybody to join in. I want everybody to share in the community of having the cake. It's like breaking bread. Because in a way, it does bind us. It's that one moment where we don't have to worry about the next deadline. It's an enjoyable moment.
Let's tick through some NPR names and the cakes that they love. Michelle Norris.
Michelle loves just about everything.
Uh-huh. Easily pleased.
She is very easily pleased. She does not like coconut.
No coconut for Michelle.
No coconut for Michelle.
Okay. Robert Siegel.
Robert does not eat cake, he claims.
He claims.
I have seen Robert take cookies, though.
We know.
Well, you're the fried pie, brown sugar pound cake, and bittersweet chocolate frosted layer cake person.
Morning Edition host, Steve Inske.
He likes butterscotch. He's a butterscotch guy.
Wouldn't have pegged him for a butterscotch guy.
Steve's full of surprises.
How about our film critic, Bob Mondello?
Bob Mondello loves coconut cake because his birthday is near Easter, and every year when he was growing up, when he had his birthday cake, it was a coconut cake. So when I'm there and it's his birthday week and I remember, I make him a coconut cake. Now, sometimes I have to please the people who don't like coconut, so what I do is I do half coconut on one side and just a regular vanilla cake on the other side so Michelle can get her slice and Bob can get his half a cake.
What about Dan Shore, our venerable news analyst?
He's partial to frosting. He likes cake as a delivery system for frosting.
I know people like that.
There are people like that. It's true.
Well, Melissa, thank you for keeping us so well fed all these Mondays.
You're welcome. And I, you know, at some point I think we're going to have to do Monday aerobics too, because everybody was complaining that I'm just making them too fat.
I think it's time.
That's All Things Considered producer Melissa Gray. Her new cookbook is All Cakes Considered, a year's worth of weekly recipes tasted, tested, and approved by the staff of All Things Considered. And you can find the recipe for her sweet potato pound cake at our website, npr.org.
And Melissa, I have a confession to make.
Yes.
That I actually did have, knowing that there was an All Things Considered piece at stake, I did have a piece of the sweet potato pound
you
cake.
You tried it.
And I tried. It was pretty good.
You claim to not be a cake eater. You actually wrote the foreword to Melissa Gray's book, and you write in there, I am the rare colleague who does not eat the cake she brings to work. But you actually do.
On occasion. But despite the rarity of that, Melissa did ask me to write the foreword to the book, which is a credit to her sense of irony.
Exactly. Thank you.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Okay, back now to that more urgent healthcare issue. Supplies of the vaccine against the swine flu are way below projections. NPR's Richard Knox reports on why there's a shortage of the vaccine and how that affects government plans to protect most Americans against the new H1N1 flu.
To get an idea of the shortage, let's look at Los Angeles. It wasn't until this weekend that they could hold swine flu vaccine clinics. L.A. County Health Commissioner Jonathan Fielding opened the first two himself.
I'm standing outside one of our vaccine clinics, which is being held in Encino, a part of Los Angeles.
He says demand was very high. Most of the people had to wait between 1 and 3 hours, and Fielding didn't see many people dropping out of the lines leading into the clinics.
We were planning to have more before this, in fact, but we had to cancel them because of the lack of vaccine.
All over the country, in cities and rural counties, there's a big gap between supply and demand.
The vaccine situation is quite frustrating. You know, the numbers that we were asked to anticipate and plan with have turned out to be gross overestimates of what have been supplied to us. And I don't understand what the issue is with the manufacturers that from 1 week to the next, they can't give us more accurate estimates.
40 million doses of vaccine were promised by the end of October, but as of last Friday, only 16 million had been shipped. I asked Dr. Ann Schuchat what went wrong. She's chief of the immunization branch at the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. She says vaccine manufacturers use chicken eggs to grow the virus for the vaccine, and until recently they didn't have the chemical they needed to run tests on the virus they were growing.
And then when they were run, the manufacturers basically found out that the product that they had was actually less than they thought they had.
On top of that, there were glitches in new machines they installed, machines that put vaccine in vials and put the vials in packages. Ann Schuchat says CDC officials didn't realize the effect of these problems until the middle of this month. Manufacturers say they're fixing the problems now, but the flu virus is roaring ahead. Vaccine production won't be able to catch up anytime soon. Schuchat says that raises an obvious question.
People wonder whether when vaccine is available for you or those in your family, will it be too late for that vaccine to give you any benefit?
It's hard to make an argument that the vaccine is going to protect very many people against this wave at the rate that it's coming out.
That's Mark Lipsitch of Harvard. He does a lot of work for the CDC trying to predict the course of swine flu.
Most of this wave will be over by the time most Americans have access to the vaccine.
Actually, Ann Schuchat disagrees. She says even when this wave of swine flu peaks, there'll still be time for many people to get vaccinated.
A key point is that even when peak occurs in any one area, half the people that are going to become infected haven't yet become infected.
LA's Health Commissioner Jonathan Fielding thinks Schuchat is the one who's right.
I don't think it's too little too late. I think it's too little. And obviously for people who get sick or who get very seriously ill, it's too late. But for many others, I think it's going to arrive in time to help prevent disease.
One more opinion. As of last week, the head of the CDC says he's had it for now with making predictions about flu vaccine. Richard Knox, NPR News.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Renee Montaigne. Good morning. Now that airbags are widely accepted in cars, they're about to make their way onto airplanes. Several airlines have begun outfitting some of their seats to comply with an FAA rule that takes full effect today. NPR's Adam Hochberg reports.
There was a time, maybe 25 years ago, when the idea of putting airbags in planes would have been seen as pointless. For decades, aviation safety focused mainly on avoiding accidents, on the theory that if a crash occurred, nobody could survive anyway. But more recently, safety experts have discovered that even in major mishaps, like planes running off runways or landing in the Hudson River, passengers can walk away unharmed if they're properly protected. And that's where airbags can help.
So here's a typical airbag assembly.
Tom Barth is research director of a company called AmSafe. It makes most of the seatbelts used on planes. And increasingly, it's been selling belts with airbags attached. At this factory in Phoenix, workers put them together. They load a deflated airbag into a narrow pouch on top of the belt and connect it to a trigger mechanism and helium-filled inflation device that will be hidden under the seat.
The airbag seatbelt looks pretty much like a standard seatbelt, so the person using it uses it like any other belt. And then on top of the seatbelt, you have the airbag sewn onto the webbing and covered with a decorative cover, people don't really notice that it's there.
AmSafe now is supplying the product to most major U.S. airlines to help comply with a new government crash standard. The rule's been phased in slowly over the past 21 years and takes full effect this week, when the seats in newly manufactured planes will have to protect passengers from a crash 16 times the force of gravity. That's roughly what you might experience in a moderate speed head-on car wreck. John Hickey at the Federal Aviation Administration says the new standard is an improvement over the former requirement of 9 times gravity force, which he says didn't provide adequate protection.
We were seeing accidents that, sure, some of them were terrible catastrophes and there was never going to be a survivor. But many of the accidents were of the nature that people were still in their seat, and if maybe it was a little bit stronger, that person could have survived.
Hickey says airbags are just one of several methods airlines can use to comply with the rule, and only a few seats on a typical plane would need them. They're unnecessary, for instance, in most of the coach cabin because airlines are installing sturdier seat backs. In a collision, those seat backs serve as an adequate cushion. Other seats, in especially spacious configurations, comply with the standard simply because there's nothing in front of them a belted passenger could hit. But where the bags often are used is in places like the bulkhead, the wall at the front of the cabin, where a crash could throw passengers into a hard surface.
We'll do this crash test, and a whole series of things will happen.
Back at AmSafe, Executive Vice President Bill Hagan leads us to a long, narrow room where two crash test dummies sit in a mock-up of an airplane cabin. The dummies hit the bulkhead at a force of 16 Gs. Then Hagan assesses the results.
The occupant in the right-hand seat was wearing just a regular two-point seatbelt. And if you look at the bulkhead in front of him, you can see a tan mark where his head struck and skidded on the bulkhead. So that's just not survivable. And the occupant on the left has the seatbelt airbag and never touched the bulkhead.
Hagan says about 1% of the world's commercial aircraft seats now are equipped with airbags, a number he says will increase as airlines replace older planes. Each of the devices costs about $1,200, compared with just $35 for a standard seatbelt. But Hagan argues they're worth the price. Though an airbag never has deployed on a commercial flight, he says several have gone off in private plane crashes, and he credits them for saving 14 lives. Adam Hochberg, NPR News.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Melissa Block. Today we're starting a series of stories about privacy, or as we are calling the series, The End of Privacy. NPR's Martin Kosty is here with us at NPR West. Martin, that title is your idea. You're calling it The End of Privacy, so the message there, forget about privacy. It's over.
Well, it's not necessarily what I'm saying, but what struck me over the last couple of years as I've done stories about privacy is how many people say this to me. They say they've given up. The technologies have become too fast. They're too good at collecting data. And in some ways, I'm hearing a lot of people say that they've sort of succumbed to what I'm calling privacy fatalism.
Privacy fatalism sounds like a pretty gloomy future to me.
Well, it's what we're going to try to look at in this series to see if that fatalism is justified. And I think a good place for us to start today is just looking at what kind of information is really out there. So, for instance, you've got a computer in front of you here in the studio. Take a look at this website. Type in nextmark.com.
Nextmark.com.
And when you look there, you see that it's a searchable site. It's sort of the Google of mailing lists. Put in a search term, let's say something medical, because that's what people care about. Bladder, perhaps?
Bladder. Okay.
That might lead to
searching
something.
Searching all mailing lists for bladder, coming up with bladder leakage database, bladder sufferers, all kinds of.
Now, these are
like
not just statistics. These are lists of people's names, their addresses, their phone numbers sometimes, tied in with their medical conditions, sometimes medical conditions that I would assume they would not want necessarily for sale, and yet here they are for sale. This has always happened in the past, of course. There's always been ways for marketers to get information about, say, our medical conditions from warranty cards for things we fill out or magazine subscriptions. But all of that is accelerating, and what we have now is sort of a switch from dial-up speeds to broadband speeds for the flow of this information into this vast data pool.
We should say I don't see the names popping up here. I would have to pay money to have access.
You would have
to
pay money.
To
you can pay. You can buy per thousand and so forth. It's definitely a commodity.
Are there regulations, Martin, on how much information these companies can collect, what kind of information they can gather?
Not really. This kind of data is pretty much unregulated in the United States. It's not legal for your doctor or your hospital to sell your medical data, of course. That is prohibited by federal law. But if you voluntarily give up your information. All the law cares about is where the information came from. Now, the industry, of course, is very adamant that it's careful, that the reputable firms aren't selling this information to just anybody. Yes, you can look at the website and see that it's for sale, but they still want to know more about you before they sell it to you. I actually called the founder and CEO of Nextmark, the site you were looking at there. His name is Joe Pitch. And he said that consumers should also keep in mind that there are some benefits to companies knowing more about us.
I think when it's done right, just as with a good friend, sharing personal information makes for a much more relevant and meaningful relationship. And without that, you're really just a number.
And this is really the crux of the issue, because people do use their personal information to get stuff, to get good relationships with companies, to get coupons, bonuses, that sort of thing. They trade their personal information. And they do it to the point where it's actually becoming a subject for economists.
Those exchanges happen daily, constantly.
That's Alessandro Acquisti. He's an Italian economist who specializes in privacy. And the way he sees things, personal information is almost a kind of currency. It's something we spend. But there's a problem.
We don't have infinite cognitive power and processing power to consider all the different options. And we take shortcuts.
Acquisti studies these shortcuts that we take. He studies how people make gut decisions about which information to disclose about themselves. For example, online. It turns out that, according to his experiments, we're influenced by website design.
People admit more sensitive, even embarrassing or illegal behaviors to a website which has been designed to look kind of cheesy.
In his experiments, he's found that subjects are more likely to admit to, say, cheating on their girlfriend or something when the questions are on this cheesy, fun-looking website. But a more formal-looking website asking the same questions gets a lot more caution and a lot more self-censorship.
So, Martin, you're saying that people sometimes will decide whether they want to share their information based on a gut instinct, but you could also be pretty rational about this, I suppose. You could read a company privacy policy and make an informed decision about what you're disclosing.
That's very true, and some people make that effort. They read the fine print. But even the experts, the people who are privacy gurus, say that's becoming harder to do because you may see a privacy policy there, but it's pretty much impossible in most situations to know where your data is going if they are sending it anywhere. It's hard to follow it through the system. Chris Hufnagel is the head of privacy programs at Berkeley Law, and he explained some of this to me.
As there's been growing awareness of how commercial data brokers operate, they've become more secretive.
We were talking in a park in San Francisco a few weeks ago. And when we met, Chris immediately opened up his laptop because he wanted to show me something.
This is an archive.
He's been saving screenshots of the websites of the big data companies over time. He's been saving screenshots of what they say about where their data is coming from. The formal term for this is data provenance. As recently as 2002, in his screenshots there, you can see that this particular data company still disclosed some details about the commercial sources of the data. It listed things like call centers or pizza delivery companies that sold information to them. But lately, that's changed.
As time goes on, this gets thinner and thinner. So pizza companies falls off the list. And then by 2006, the provenance is gone.
Nothing listed for provenance?
They basically say things like, the process includes proprietary files. That essentially means it's sources that they've gathered, but they won't tell you what those sources are.
Now, it should be noted that data brokers have good business reasons to keep their sources secret. They may be trade secrets or something the other guy hasn't discovered. But Hufnagel also believes that there is some political motivation behind this.
If consumers knew the extent to which this information was being collected and repackaged, there would be riots in the streets.
Riots in the streets,
Yeah, it's
Martin.
a bit of an overstatement, and you know he cares deeply about these things. But there is some truth to the fact that American privacy laws have traditionally been driven by scandals. That's why, for example, we have federal protections for our video rental records. It's because there was a dust-up in the 80s because someone published the lineup for Judge Robert Bork's personal movie nights.
Yeah, right.
So that's why we have that protection. It's always about a scandal. And now as data companies are beginning to extend their reach into interesting new areas, like social networks, it's probably a smart thing to keep some of those new sources below the radar.
You're talking about social networks like Facebook, for example. How valuable would that kind of data be?
Well, you remember how Alessandro Acquisti was talking about the cheese factor?
Yes.
Well, the fact is that people are less inhibited about themselves on informal websites. And that's true on social sites especially. And data companies now know that. They want that information that you're sharing so freely about yourself on social sites. And that's what tomorrow's story is all about.
Okay, NPR's Martin Kosty, thanks so much.
My pleasure.
You can find more from our series, The End of Privacy, at npr.org. There's a breakdown of some of the costs and rewards of sharing your personal information.
This is NPR, National Public Radio.
We don't know if they have an airbag to deploy, but it does look like the United States Olympic Committee has hit some trouble. The committee is back in crisis mode after years of turmoil and just 3 weeks after Chicago's bid of the 2016 Summer Games was rejected. Olympic athletes and sports executives are again demanding major change. NPR's Howard Berkus tells us why.
Rebellion was already brewing in the U.S. Olympic world when this was announced October 2nd.
The city of Chicago, having obtained the least number of votes, will not participate in the next round.
Chicago's early exit from the 2016 Olympic bidding unleashed pent-up frustration among athletes and Olympic sports federations. Lisa Delpy Narati is an Olympic scholar at George Washington University.
That's when they came out with their guns slinging. They withheld their complaints and their unhappiness until the Chicago bid was done.
The first casualty is Stephanie Streeter, the acting CEO of the U.S. Olympic Committee, who announced she wouldn't seek her job permanently. Streeter's the latest in a string of U.S. Olympic leaders with solid corporate credentials, but little or no Olympic or sports experience. It's a familiar formula to Olympic journalist Mary Jo Borzolleri.
The USOC went through four presidents and four CEOs between 2000 and 2003. And while you haven't seen that rate of change now, you're seeing the same sort of instability and inner turmoil that you saw back then.
At stake is the U.S. Olympic Committee's core mission, says Skip Gilbert, who runs USA Triathlon.
If all of the energy is trying to right the ship, if you will, is that taking away from the energy needed to create programs to bring better athletes into the pipeline, to develop them for Olympic competition? And we would hate for something to fall through the cracks that could at any level put any of our athletes or any of our sports at a disadvantage.
The dissatisfaction focuses on departing CEO Stephanie Streeter and board chairman Larry Probst.
These are two of the highest sports jobs in the country, and they're right now being filled by two people with no sports experience.
Doug Logan heads USA Track and Field and joined the majority of Olympic sports executives in a recent vote of no confidence in the top U.S. Olympic leadership.
Sports is not rocket science, but by the same token, it is a business in and of itself that has got its own set of relationships, which are rather unique, and to fill both of those jobs by individuals who have no knowledge or experience with sports, that's got to be rethought.
Some Olympic athletes have the same concern. Former triple jumper Willie Banks heads the U.S. Olympians Association.
They have a great understanding of how a corporation should be run, but unfortunately that is not what we have here. The understanding that they lack is that this is a public trust. We don't sell anything. We raise money to put a team out on the field of play during the Olympic Games.
The athletes and sports executives also want more say in U.S. Olympic policy. Board Chairman Larry Probst was not available for an interview by NPR's deadline, but in a teleconference earlier this month, he seemed to agree with his critics with this description of the ideal U.S. Olympic CEO.
It's somebody that has the executive skills that Stephanie has, married with a background in sports, someone who is multilingual, someone who is willing to make a very long-term commitment, and that we believe can build the long-term relationships that we need to have with IOC members.
Those references to the International Olympic Committee and to language skills address other perceived weaknesses in the U.S. Olympic leadership. Probst also acknowledged the disenfranchised and divisive atmosphere.
We want buy-in and support from all the constituencies so that we're all on the same page and all moving together in a positive fashion.
Probst has meetings scheduled this week with Olympic athletes, sports executives, and other members of the Olympic family to try to stem the turmoil. He hopes to have a new CEO hired by the end of the year, but he says he won't step down. Howard Berkus, NPR News.